I'd like to welcome you all to the second to last panel at South by Southwest. Congratulations for making it this long. It is the second to last one.
Wow. Yes.
My name is Chris Himes. I'm the founder of B-Side, and I will be moderating, although there's only three of us, so that That might be a little loose here. Unfortunately, Joe Swanberg is ill and will not be here, so those of you who came here just to see Joe, you can leave now. Today's panel is Filmmakers on Demand, and it is a discussion about VOD and digital distribution and all of those things that I mentioned earlier. Probably a better name for the panel would be the famous William Goldman quote, "Nobody knows anything." So I think the theme here is, at least the other two people at the table here have a lot of experience and hopefully will have some insight. But one of the more interesting things is that there's probably more questions that will be raised around this topic than definitive answers you might get. What we'll probably do, again, since there's only three of us, is do some talking up here first for a little bit, but then definitely open up to questions on the outside. I can also say, just because I'm a geek and this is a fun thing I saw Eugene do on his panel earlier, if anyone has any questions and they want to send them to me, and they actually Eugene got several questions emailed to him, so you can email them, for those of you with an iPhone or a BlackBerry, to Hyams, H-Y-A-M-S, at bside.com, and I'll feel free to read those off if you're shy. Otherwise, we'll get in line by the microphones over there and start asking questions. So let me start with a couple of brief introductions, but then I'll let Lizzie and Kip do their own. Directly to my right is Kip McClanahan, who is the founder of On Networks, an Austin, Texas-based company that focuses on, I believe, acquiring and producing short-form HD content for distribution to multiple different screens, and Kip will explain exactly what that means. And then all the way down at the end is Lizzie Nastro, who is the Director of Acquisitions for IFC Films. And so let me turn it over quickly to let Kip and Lizzie do a brief introduction themselves.
Sure.
Thank you. My name is Kip McClanahan. I'm the CEO of On Networks. And On Networks basically is a new media company. We focus on, just like Chris said, acquiring through a number of different ways, original, high def, short form typically, content. And we distribute that across a vast on-demand network that really is both a mix of online and offline platforms. So whether that is our website or iTunes or YouTube, which I would call online, or offline with folks like AT&T, Time Warner, Comcast, more traditional distribution platforms. We really see, and I think this is the crux of the on-demand nature, the need for content to be free, to be on every screen, you know, where and how and when consumers want. And I think the detail there, which I know we'll get into, so I'll make it short now, is really what drives an increasingly on-demand world, whether you're talking about original, you know, episodic content or films or, you know, anything in between, including user-generated content. So that's the... That's a very Reader's Digest version of On Networks, and I'll
let Lizzie go.
Hi. I guess I can start with the... At IFC, I acquire completed films, usually at film festivals, to then put into our distribution model that consists of it's a day and date model, meaning that it is released in the theater and on VOD, video on demand, the same day. So that is sort of, in a nutshell, what our goal is and what we've built, the infrastructure we've built over the last 2 years, mostly because we're owned by a Cablevision, a huge cable company, and they have an infrastructure of with other cable carriers for video on demand to be available in 50 million homes, which is huge and vast and really new. And that's basically what we've been acquiring for. It's similar to IFC in the past, but just more of it, and collapsing the window between theatrical and VOD to happen on the same day.
Great. So I think we can start. The concept of video on demand is a very broad concept. You could literally interpret it to just mean cable VOD. I think the way that the panel description was written, and probably what hopefully most people are interested in here, is the broader definition of the ability to distribute content through non-physical means directly to people whenever and wherever they want it. This year has been an interesting one, mostly in terms of not necessarily people making money through VOD, but in the collapsing of the previous system. DVD sales for the fourth year are down. It's the first half of 2007. They were down another 12.5%. You had the writer strike, which was driven essentially entirely by this concept of there's a big pile of money out there somewhere. Nobody really knows what it is, but whatever it is, we want a piece of it. And then you had interesting things happen in the news, like Radiohead putting up their album and essentially letting people name their own prices, and lots and lots of arguments and discussions about whether or not that was a good thing or a bad thing and whether or not that could work for anyone else. But it's definitely been something that's really at the forefront of all the thinking about what is next for the film business, especially relevant for independent filmmakers, because with the cost of theatrical as out of control as they are right now, most filmmakers are probably not going to see their film playing on a big screen. And so, one of the questions really is, and I think the first one, which is a good one to start with, is who are the people that are actually making money doing this right now? And to explore some of those different models where that's being done. So I know that you guys have a very specific model in terms of how your content is distributed and supported by advertising. And Lizzie, the video on demand model obviously is very different for Cablevision. So I'd love to hear both of you talk a little bit about just the concept of where is the money being made in your models.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. Let me, if I can, take one half step back to frame up how we look at monetizing content and why we think broad video on demand distribution is important. So just by way of a little bit of context, I mean, we think at On Networks, and we believe deeply that if you look at what is driving this increasing notion of it becoming an on-demand world, it is the fact that consumer control, this is my standard, video on demand rant. Consumer control is at an all-time high. So the fact that we as consumers who are interested in whether it's short form content or independent film or mainstream film or music and what have you, our ability to have a historically unprecedented amount of control about what we watch, where we watch it or listen to it, when and how we do that is absolutely at an all-time high. And so it's certainly not going to wane from that. It will probably only accelerate. And so as that acceleration happens, as we exercise that control, that's what creates audience fragmentation. That's what drives adoption of different platforms, different devices, and creates the opportunity that we're talking about here across a number of different business models, to answer your question, but also makes this notion of on-demand content really sort of the cat's out of the bag, the genie's out of the bottle. There's really no going back. In fact, if you think about television, the notion of a TiVo or a digital video recorder is really nothing more than a device to convert linear programming to on-demand programming. So if you think nothing more than about traditional television moving to an on-demand world, that's what a TiVo is. So I mean, we are going down that path. As we're going down that path, this is a nascent market. And so to get to really how do you monetize that and where what works and what doesn't, it's literally a platform by platform answer. And so if you think about online, online platforms today have a much more, believe it or not, advanced model around monetizing on-demand content through advertising. Much more advanced than the Time Warners and the Comcasts of the world for on-demand. From a linear perspective, it's just the opposite. And so what you can see is you'll see advertising models be adopted and delivered, with revenue against online a little bit more frequently than you will offline. And you'll see licensing, in fact, around on-demand content happen in the offline world around VOD platforms. Now, the interesting thing, especially, when we talk about, independent monetization, so indie monetization, what's really, and I'd love to hear, Lizzie's perspective on this, but we know for a fact that in the on-demand world of programming for platforms like the cable companies, there's an interesting relationship between the linear business, take Discovery, for example. The Discovery Channel has a linear deal, that is the tip of the spear, and everything VOD-oriented with Discovery is entirely predicated on what they're throwing in to make that linear deal as sweet as they can for themselves. And so there's also a history of challenge in thinking about offline VOD programming is something that you're paying for independently, because historically it's been thrown in to get the linear deal done. And so, that's a lot of words to suggest that really what we're in the middle of right now is the early stage of model development and testing and trialing. And so to the extent that Chris said, what we'll find out is that there's a lot of questions yet to be answered. That's very true. Now, I will tell you for sure that there is money that's flowing without question in advertising-sponsored models, in licensing-oriented models. And I think you're going to see a bunch of interesting direct models crop up. I think the opportunity for merchandising to be a really interesting component of what it means to be on-demand or direct revenue to consumer for, you know, extra features or premium content, you know, the behind the scenes for a movie perhaps, I think are just as viable because of this commoditization of distribution platforms. So, you know, like I said, that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, there are a number of models being tested and trial, and we can certainly dig into the details of that. But I guess the short version is on-demand is only going to accelerate, and I think the business models are going to be predicated on a platform-by-platform model.
Money. I guess that ideally for us, we want to create a system or have created a system that the scenario is best for everyone involved, including the filmmaker, producers, and us that take the risk to put the film out theatrically. So with our program, that the fact that it's in theaters and on video on demand same day, and you can capitalize on people buying in their homes when sometimes it just might be released in New York or LA, and that's as far as the film goes. This is hopefully reaching a much wider audience, not only for exposure, but a download is $6.99. So, which is in every across the U.S. So for us, we hope to keep costs low and keep budgets lean and what makes sense rather than throwing money out the door for no reason that you may never see again. So our, I guess, goal, I mean, it's an ideal way of looking at it, but is to hopefully get returns to filmmakers and producers after a couple of years of it being in different windows, i.e. iTunes or VOD or DVD. And I guess in terms of us, I think we have a concentrated pool if we're talking about money. I mean, it's very much like cable carriers, us and filmmakers are the ones that are involved. And then iTunes and there's many more ways to start seeing films. And I think that's really adapting and starting now with, I guess, Blockbuster Movie Link. And then there's this thing, theotours.com, which is free watching for really critically acclaimed films from, you know, 1970, French films, foreign films, specialized films. And I think we're going to see a lot of new platforms, which is what Kip was saying. And I think we just launched the program called Festival Direct, which is taking the best films from festivals and putting them straight to video on demand. And I think what's going to be interesting to see that for us is taking out the theatrical element of that and seeing if these films do well with just the standalone video on demand or cable promotion and people's interest to see movies like this at home. So I think for us, as Kip was saying, like, I think it's definitely seeing your model and seeing how it works and seeing how people respond to it. I'm excited about it just because we get to work with a lot more filmmakers than, say, a mini major who are doing great things but can, you know, acquire 3 films a year. For our program, we acquire 24, and then Festival Direct is many more than that. So for us, that's an exciting way to be able to work with a lot of filmmakers and put it in a new model, whereas in the past, it's a bit scary to handle that many films because it's just that volume is so high and the money is, you have to spend a lot. So by creating a model, you can sort of keep your costs in check and create a template of sorts. And I think that's online anyways what people are trying to move toward and have started creating, which is fascinating too because there's so many new ways to see films. And I don't think the film industry is oversaturated. I actually think, like, let's bring movies to people who want to see them. Like, let's keep making the movies and let's find ways to put them out there in the zeitgeist.
So, in as much as we lost a panelist, I'm going to hop in because Chris is supposed to be the moderator, but he also runs a really cool company in town called B-Side, and he's squarely in the middle of this exact question he asked us to. So I'd like to at least give you an opportunity to talk about monetization and the models that you're seeing, because yeah, I know what you're doing, but it's neat.
Sure. Thanks for the for the softball. You know, I think so. B-Side is a business that is focused specifically on two things in the independent film world. One is on finding great films at festivals that are being missed by the other distributors. And the second part is in finding ways for those films to make money. And we find films we run the film festival websites for about 150 festivals and gather feedback from audience members and use that to help us see things that are popping from with various audiences at various festivals. And then we do everything from distribute directly on bside.com up through, we have a partnership with the television side of IFC, where we have a new program that once a month shows air on IFC TV, and then we'll go out through various distribution outlets with IFC as well. Our focus really is in trying to find specifically ways for filmmakers to make money from their work. And it's one of the biggest challenges, I think, of this space in general, is that the whole concept of, you know, what people refer to as a long tail business in general, where you're selling lots of different titles in small quantities of each. That's actually great for the aggregators. It's really not great for the individual filmmakers whose titles might be selling 10 or 20 or 30 copies. And so explicitly, you know, what we've seen is that the films that have done well on bside.com are ones that are not just for sale online. They actually need to have some other component, whether it's Before the Music Dies, which just aired on IFC TV and saw a huge spike in terms of people actually coming to the site to buy the DVD or downloads after having seen it online, or films that have done their own work to build an audience, like Four Eyed Monsters. I'm sure some of you have seen Aaron and Susan speaking here. That film has been up on B-Side for the last 9 months. The most interesting thing, I think, from our perspective, and where we definitely have a very similar perspective to Kip's, at least, is that the answer is not putting something in one place and letting people buy it there. I think the whole concept of audiences want to consume content in a whole bunch of different settings, on a whole bunch of different devices, at a whole bunch of different times. And if you just present one way, you're going to dramatically limit the possibility of how many people are going to take 90 minutes out of their day to sit down and watch a documentary. In our case, that means we sell both downloads and DVDs, because not everyone necessarily is ready to do a download. I think a more interesting question is whether in this digital world, the model of free ad-supported versus pay-per-view rental versus download to own, you know, which of those is going to, if it is going to turn out that one of those is going to be the dominant way that people want to consume this content, or is the answer that it has to be all three? Apple recently decided that it's at least two of those. And if you looked at Apple's numbers, that's actually one of the most, you know, telling things for me. Apple released their numbers from last year on electronic sell-through. They have more than 50% of the market, so more than 50% of features bought by people and downloaded to their Mac or PC were sold by Apple. And that number for feature films was 7 million last year. So at $9.99 or less, that's less than the, you know, opening weekend for a big Hollywood film for the entire year for the entire business. Now, they also did say that they sold 190 million TV episodes. So clearly there's a market for people paying what they view as a sort of throwaway $1.99 or $2.99 for 30 minutes of content, because you can watch that on your iPhone and you're not going to watch Lawrence of Arabia on your iPhone. But so actually, you know, you've watched Lawrence of Arabia.
No, just kidding.
I watch docs all the time on my iPhone. I think it's the greatest thing in the world. But I haven't watched a big sort of cinematic thing. So it's actually one of the, just to sort of throw it back, and I guess we'll just ping pong here. I'm interested to see from your perspective. I know you guys are just starting with the whole iTunes thing. You've announced the exclusive with Blockbuster around the window for rental, and I believe that's also for digital for Blockbuster. Is that correct?
Yep.
And then you've obviously got the very well-established VOD business. Without saying things that you're not allowed to say because they're private,
and
feel free to not answer any part of this. I think one of the questions I think that probably a lot of the filmmakers here would have is, how many people are using these various things? When you take a title that's been successful across multiple different channels, what is the ratio, again, without getting into numbers, of people who actually bought it on VOD versus maybe saw it on television versus possibly saw it in a theater? Do you have any?
Well, I mean, it dramatically varies per film. I think a genre film does really well on video on demand. I mean, on video too. It's just the nature of things. So we have eclectic types of films. So we have like French films that were competition in Cannes Film Festival. We have films that are more genre driven. We have Spanish language films. And I think that we created it that way so that we can sort of kind of see, like, what are people watching at home? And for some reason, Spanish language does really well in VOD. Genre does really well. French films were fine, and now there's a spike in it. It's just, I mean, I'm not sure about, like, the numbers of this, but we have been seeing it grow. I think we started out in 25 million homes, and now we're in 50 million homes. So I just think that these cable carriers see a need to adapt to or get content, I guess, is what it comes down to, is try and find quality content. In terms of iTunes, that's fairly new, but we are one of the only independent studios that have a deal with them to put our films in there. And they are really overloaded. So it's like they have to keep on making films available, which has been a feat for them just because there's so much available now that they have and they want to use. We had a documentary that we bought at Sundance a few years ago called CSA, Confederate States of America. I love this film, and that is a really controversial film about if the South would won the Civil War, what had happened. And I really responded to it at Sundance. We bought it. It did well in theaters, and then on video demand, there was this sort of like symbiosis. Like it was like the buzz from both created sort of both platforms to do really evenly. That happened with When the Chicks the Barley, the Ken Loach film. So I think it sort of, in one way, it fuels the theatrical, I think, what we're finding, and especially on films that sort of be films that everyone has a little bit of interest in the independent film world, like a Ken Loach film, he has an audience. And CSA is just doing so well. It keeps growing on iTunes, and it's like this doc that, I don't know who even saw it at Sundance, but we all really responded to it, and we thought it was really important, and clearly people do too, and that's just fascinating to me that can happen in a way that was never available in the past. So I guess to your question, it's just I think we're still seeing, and every film is different, but there definitely are a lot of viewers out there. I mean, it's a genre film can go on, above 90,000 buys, which I'm not pinning down any film, but that's a lot of buys for one film that may only be in two cities theatrically. So I think, one, it's creates like a little bit of buzz. Like I think with Darjeeling Limited, when they put that short on iTunes, and then I think I read an article in the New York Times, like it fueled the theatrical. There was like a lull sort of after the opening weekend, and then they started running the short on iTunes for free. And it sort of, there was a growth in the box office. So it's all very interesting to see. For us, hopefully, our goal is to not just have the VOD genre-driven stuff, but to create sort of films that can be out there and on video on demand and both survive.
So one of the things that occurred to me while Lizzie was talking, I think it's, in businesses that have a traditional component tied to like the independent film channel, I think it's the easiest first step out in terms of imagining what does what on which platforms is to imagine how it bolsters and supports the core business. And then how at some point, the core business shifts and becomes maybe something else. And what we've seen, I think it's interesting at an industry level perspective, since this panel is on VOD, I think there's a massive historical know-how around what it means to program linear channels, right? Then back to, what happens at prime time and, soap operas on at certain parts of the day. And I think that there's just there's a rich history. There's a job description in most media companies that have that. And I think there is a massive gap, on the other hand, in terms of the knowledge of what it takes to program a VOD world, a VOD network. And that's one of the things that, in as much as On Network's distribution model is truly any screen, any geography, any time, we have to know what it means to program a VOD network. And it's very, very different than what it takes to program a linear network. And so without any historic core business model, we're, unfortunately we don't have one, but we're also unencumbered from a core business model in the past. We actually start to see some really interesting things. We have a bunch of different content. We have content that spans a bunch of demographics, a bunch of different passion areas. And what we start to see across different VOD networks is that there's different behaviors across each one of those. So, for example, I can tell you that there are different demographic characteristics of YouTube versus AT&T versus MySpace versus iTunes. And I can tell you, and we're developing, you know, part of what we have to be good at is that intuition and the data that supports that intuition around what demographic does well on what platform, what show needs to go on that platform, especially if you're going to go run an ad-supported business model. The notion of being able to put content out into this VOD, aggregated VOD digital network, and understand what it's going to do and how it's going to do, and that you're optimizing around that, is an extremely different notion than programming a linear channel where it's really, you know, time in the day and a lot of the historical calculus that happens there. And so, you know, I think the question's a really interesting one, because right now the thing that we've seen, especially as ad dollars flow into non-traditional advertising and people who are used to traditional media buys start trying to imagine how they buy, you know, across these fragments, you know, targeting the demographics that they're used to targeting, there's really a huge gap in information of where and how those demographics live. And so, you know, whether you're putting an independent film out into iTunes or YouTube or some cable or IPTV VOD platform, there needs to be a belief and knowledge around how that content's going to perform, because, you know, the consumer control that I talked about before is delivering a wealth of choice, right? And the consequence of a wealth of choice is a poverty of attention for any one particular platform. So you've got to align and optimize particular pieces of content for particular platforms. And if you don't do that, you're never going to cause people to take time out of their day, like you said, to watch any particular thing. So the notion of programming a VOD network is a really important one. I just think there's a gap in information, and we're trying to crack that nut as well. And I think we've gone down the path, but you know, this is early days again for that, but it's going to be increasingly important.
So along similar lines and on the pricing model, one of the things that I think that is clear from a consumer demand perspective is that free is a really good price. For anyone who reads Wired, the cover story this month, and Chris Anderson's new book is called Free: Why $0 is the Business Model of the Future. And it's definitely a great read for anyone. One of the things that they talk about, though, is that there's a much bigger difference between zero and one penny, and, you know, one penny and a dollar, or a dollar and $10. And when you offer something for free, the adoption is astronomical compared to getting someone to pull out their credit card for anything. So one of the things that is interesting, obviously, in your model with that ad supported, you get to take advantage of that. I know that.
Don't ask me that question.
well, because I know that IFC does have VOD that is both pay, and there's also free VOD as well. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is the question, and IFC, the television network, obviously, is sponsorship supported. Specifically as it relates to independent content, it's more of a philosophical, it's not based on questions or answers. You know, the film festival model is very different, right? You get people to come and sit, you know, and stand in long lines in the rain for documentaries that they've never heard of before, because there's buzz going on here, or because it's South by Southwest and everyone's here talking about stuff. What is it about, I guess it's a sort of broader question, what is it about festivals that makes people willing to stand in long lines on the rain, you know, on a Tuesday night to go see something they've never heard of, but we're parting with $8, you know, at a regular theater, or spending their $6.99 on video on demand? Why is that? Because again, I'm trying to focus on independent filmmakers in the room who are thinking, how is this going to help me at some point? You know, is the answer that there is going to have to be a different model between Spider-Man and, you know, and a great documentary, or something like CSA, that's an important and interesting and challenging film, but it's not popcorn entertainment.
Right. So wait, your question about seeing it at a festival. I mean, I think that people like to see things first, and a festival provides with seeing something that they can see. They may never be able to see in a theater or any platform, and they can see it before other people. And I think in the festival atmosphere, when filmmakers are present and there's Q&As, I think it just fosters a natural inclination to kind of see what it's about. I mean, that would be my sort of basic answer about the festival. What is the other question?
So I guess the question is there going to have to be a different model for independent content to be able to be successful in this world? Is it necessarily going to be the same thing that's going to work for Spider-Man, that's going to work for the kind of films that you're looking, that you think are great for audiences to see, but might they have to be presented in a different way or a different pricing structure?
Than what we currently have?
Than Hollywood versus independent.
Yeah, than traditional.
Which might be different than what you already have. It might be that what you have is already working well, but there, I think a larger question for me is, and for probably a lot of people in the room, how can a great independent documentary that might have a worldwide audience of 50,000 people, how can it reach those 50,000 people now that the technological barrier to getting it everywhere is essentially zero? It's the how do you get these people to find out about it, and what is the price, what is the right model, and is that different from the Hollywood stuff?
Well, I mean, we're working, that's, you know, sort of what we're working at. Is it the right situation for the film? For us, anyway, just because we have this built already, the cable carriers are really behind our program. So there's a lot of promotion that happens on the cable level. Not necessarily would see, you know, in mainstream magazines or the newspaper, but it happens. Like if you have Time Warner in the city, you'd go to Channel 1000 and you can, our trailers for all our films that are currently on video on demand will have, you know, looped reel, or there'll be little tidbits about the film on and on. And there's an incredible amount of promotion across in every market, because if we bring the content to them and then the content is successful for them, then it's a viable business. I mean, it comes down for us. I mean, that's where it helps to have that infrastructure already built, because we can sort of like work together. We give them something and they'll promote it and hopefully make it available or known for audiences everywhere. I mean, that's sort of the goal. What I stressed before, like the exposure to these films is what we're really going after. You know, hopefully people will adapt more and more to video. I mean, that's not my only hope, to be video on demand, but it certainly is sort of a light in all of this idea of, you know, there's either the mini major independent film and then there's the rest. So there's like these two groups right now that have come out of this marketplace, and it's the mini major has a veteran director, sizable budget, recognizable cast. And that's a handful or more than a handful a year. And then there's this whole other pile with like really strong emerging voices, may not have any stars in it or the budget's, you know, low, whatever it is, all these factors that don't, you know, like a Paramount Vantage wouldn't necessarily be attracted to or buy or take the risk on theatrically. At least this is sort of a way to do that and take, we acquired, Joe's not here, but we acquired Nights and Weekends at South by Southwest, and he's really into IFC and what we're doing because he thinks that film, he wants to reach a really big audience, and I think on video on demand, especially for his film, it could really, really work on a really good level. So,
and you guys acquired Joe's last film, right?
Yeah, we did last year after South by Southwest, Hannah Takes the Stairs, and then Nights and Weekends now. So, and Joe's even doing a thing called Young American Bodies with IFC TV. It's like webisodes. So, I think when people are really interested to find there are other ways of getting their films out there, that's when it really is great. So you can sort of work together and find out the best. And sometimes it's hard to be like the focus on theatrical is just, it's just not a reality in this marketplace anymore for specialized and foreign films. And it's not to say it won't happen because people are so, but just the screen space to fighting for screen space alone is really difficult. So at least there is a way to kind of partner in another form of distribution.
Actually, I have a question. So when IFC acquires a property, I mean, this is probably hard to answer specifically, but maybe in the abstract, what's that worth to an indie filmmaker? Like what can you return to them? I mean, is that a...
Well, I'd like to think that... no, that's a good question. I'd like to think that... we can, thankfully, we are very passionate about film because we distribute a lot of it. And we like to really pick a film that we think will, we either, if it's in the theaters, released theatrically, that we feel that has a press angle, or there's that we just love it and we think this filmmaker is a really talented and new voice. We acquired Ballast out of Sundance by this director, Lance Hammer. It's set in the Mississippi Delta. Just a really beautiful but really sort of slow, beautiful film. I mean, that's the best way to describe it. And that's a scary thing for other people, other companies to take on, I guess. But we know that we can, this critic will like it or this person will be attracted to it. So hopefully it's creating a home. What we can bring is creating a home for this new talent. I think that there's a lot of great talent out there, especially at South by Southwest. Seeing all these movies here is great. Not just like the Sundance competition movie. That's not the end all be all. There's a lot more places to see really good films. And hopefully we can kind of bring them a distribution experience that A, they understand, they can collaborate with, and then take something away from that and then come back again. And like with Joe, he really reached out to us again with Nights and Weekends because he was happy with the way we sort of took care of Hannah and weren't saying, oh, we're going to put in 1,000 theaters. Like, that's not that film. And we treated it the way that it should be treated without, giving unrealistic expectations for the film. So hopefully, to answer your question, to sum up my monologue, I think that it's just a way to experience distribution at a level that is smart and hopefully real, and learn from that, and then make a really just big to be movie fun, and leave us for a big studio.
So these panels are always, most fun when you get into the, scarier nooks and crannies for businesses in the space. So let me be provocative. So On Networks gives a small advance to its content creators and in order to help them cover production. And then what we do is we offer a rev share on the back end. So when you work with On Networks as somebody who's producing content, creating content, really what you're betting on is On Networks' ability to be a marketing, monetization, distribution engine. And so that back end, from an On Networks perspective, depending on, whether you're Steven Spielberg or an unknown person, sort of is in the 0% to 50% range. I'd love to understand provocatively, what does it look like? I mean, that's sort of the direction of my question before. For folks in the room who are at South by Southwest who probably are trying to figure out how to make money in this business, what's the model for them working with us?
I don't want to be too provocative.
No. I mean, the only thing I think of, we're not like the record company that builds like a little stand in a town and is like, give us $2,000 and we'll make you a star. Like, that's certainly not what we're doing.
The model more than anything else.
Like, no, I think it's very similar. I think that every model for film deals is similar across the board for every company. Just, depends on the level you're working with for your advance, which is, your upfront money that you get from a film and what you get, what you negotiate for what you're getting in the back end. I think every deal is probably very similar for all of us. I mean, just depending on, maybe not so much you, yeah. I don't know exactly.
So our model is a little simpler because we don't have the broad distribution network you have and we then partner with people to get that. Our model is probably very similar in yours. It's just we take a 30% distribution fee and 70% goes to the filmmakers and we don't pay advances. But then if we take a film that's going to go through somewhere else where it is going to get an advance, that's going to go through the filmmaker and we'll recoup against that. I can tell you just from having talked to a whole host of distributors and looked at a whole bunch of different deals, what Lizzie said is accurate, that every deal is going to have some form of advance, which might be zero, and then some form of back end.
I think the most important thing about, regardless of how the deal is structured, it's more how much you spend. And maybe not so much on your guys' end, but on ours, like, you have to be smart about what you're spending to then hope to get to recoupment. And I think that's where in the...
Spending in promotion?
Yeah, publicity and advertising or making prints or whatever it is, all those costs that go into bringing it out into the theaters and... putting a television ad is extremely expensive. You have to say, oh, is that what I want for this film. Is that going to help my film, our film, be out more in the theaters? Maybe not. And so why spend that money? Because you know what? It's only coming out of all your collective pockets to then have to come back again when you start selling movie tickets or downloads. So I think, every deal is probably very similar, but it lies in just being smart about what you spend to get your film out there. And that's why I think both of your sort of setups are great, because I think the costs, or I would imagine the costs, to be probably pretty low to be able to have people see films.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to put a point on that, it's lower when you put the right piece of content on the right network that has the right, adoption, capability on it. But yeah, I can imagine folks sitting in South by Southwest trying to, understand a little bit about how some of the mechanics of some of these new type of deals or more traditional type of deals work. And so,
And I think
thank you for letting me play moderator for one second.
And one of the challenges, and then because we have about 20 minutes, I would like to open it up for questions. The way the business has worked for the last 5 or 6 years, from 1999 to 2004, when DVDs basically became the profit source for the film business, 75% of all of the growth in the industry came from DVD sales from 99 to 2004. And that was a huge seismic shift, because the business used to be the theatrical business. 100% of the receipts 50 years ago were people buying tickets and seeing movies in movie theaters. And today, worldwide, it's less than 15% of gross revenues come from theatrical. And that's been declining every year and will continue to do so. And so today, the theatrical business is essentially the loss leader. And anyone who says otherwise is not being honest. Distributors lose money releasing films in movie theaters, and they make money on DVDs and other ancillaries. The interesting thing is that, you have, and this is one of the things that the Wired article talks about, is that nothing really is free when you give something away for free. In theory, it's because you're getting something on the back end, and you're willing to lose money. Dell loses money selling PCs and makes money on memory and warranties. And almost every business has a similar model. The problem now is that you're getting squeezed, because the theatrical business loses money and DVDs are starting to make money. As that's starting to erode, right now the digital business is not making up for those losses. It's not like you can start to lose money on DVDs and make it, because people are used to getting stuff for free on the internet. And so one of the interesting things that I think is, and you guys are already there with traditional VOD, is the problem with digital distribution. One of the 57 problems with digital distribution today is what I like to think of as the last 10-foot problem. People with broadband used to talk about the last 100-foot problem, which is the reason we all don't have T1s, is getting that fiber optic connection into your house. The 10-foot problem for me is getting the thing from my laptop onto my plasma. Everyone has 42-inch HD TVs, and I think that if every single piece of content that came through festivals was available in HD on demand for everyone's plasma, you'd see a completely different economy, because people actually are willing to pay $6.99, $2.99, whatever, to watch something on their TV. And I think that most people are still making that leap to paying for something to watch on your laptop or on your phone.
Or just adapting to the technology still. I mean, a lot of homes, you just might not have that set up yet. I think the trend obviously is going toward that way to more and more homes. But yeah, I mean, I think that's also the sort of the slow, the progress of it is just also not having.
Right. So Apple's trying to get there with a device that in theory is going to be as simple as the iPod that everyone can plug into their TV.
The last release of software did definitely a step forward.
Although interestingly, I think the two companies, and then I'll open it up right after this, the two companies that I think are the farthest along in kind of stealth mode with this are Microsoft, because there's 6.4 million Xboxes connected to HD TVs around the U.S. that are all connected to broadband, and they can actually deliver HD content to your place. So most grown-ups don't know that their kid's Xbox, they can order HD movies on demand and watch them on their plasma.
I feel like a scamming up here. I have like my grandmother's old TV. I sort of like need to upgrade, I guess.
And the other is Cisco, because they actually own Scientific Atlanta, so they're actually plugged into more HD TVs around the country than anyone else. But
that's true.
That's a difference. So let's open it up for questions here. Yes. Yeah. So did anyone not hear the question? The question to restate it was basically what I really want is the ability to search for any movie and then order it immediately on my television. And so I'd actually like to, I mean, I have some theories myself on why that doesn't exist and why it's going to take a while before we get there.
To have them linked. I mean, we don't have that. Ours would just be go to the video on movies on demand channel and scroll and through all the list and see trailers and descriptions, and hopefully you'll download one of them. Ours are, you could go to our website, but definitely they're not linked. And I don't know, I don't actually know the answer of that. I just know sort of like what we do.
I mean, the reason everybody's been talking about convergence for the last dozen years, I mean, at least, I guarantee you it's been at least that.
It means something different now than it did 2 years
ago. And it's an evolving concept. But I'll tell you that, in my opinion, the short answer why you're not going to see just, you know, inherent convergence happen as quickly as it technologically could is because it has no economic support for the people who could drive that convergence. So if you think about the economic model of a NBC, the fact that that channel makes its money by aggregating eyeballs to one spot so that they can sell ad dollars against that. And every time one of those eyeballs goes somewhere else, that is one fraction less ad dollars that they can go get. You're not going to see them, erode that core business model, because as Chris said before, the digital dollars aren't there to support it yet. So you'll see them do things like Hulu and test and trial. But what you won't see them do is enable, from a rights perspective, from a technology perspective, from a model perspective, convergence, because they don't have displacement. They don't have replacement dollars for their business model. And so, you know, you'll find companies, I think, like Microsoft and Cisco, who want to enable that. And I think, you know, they're going to go real fast and real hard until they bump square up against, you know, rights issues that are going to be, you know, absolutely ruled with an iron fist, because any time that those sort of eke out, that's going to steal dollars away from a core business model that can't be replaced. So I think it's economics that are keeping convergence from happening quickly.
Yeah. And you mentioned the magic words, which is rights. The technology has existed for a long time, as long as BitTorrent has been around. Right, the technology for people to download content in full DVD resolution and watch it on their plasma has been around, and people are willing to wait 2 or 3 hours to get that. The issue is, and this is something that you hear Ted Sarandos from Netflix talk about all the time, the reason they started Red Envelope was to basically get more content that they had digital rights for. Netflix has 90,000 titles that you can rent on DVD today, and about 4,800 they have the digital rights for. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the way television rights were bought 5 and 10 years ago
were defined,
vaguely enough such that there's a lot of people who believe they have the digital rights because they had the television, right? And so it's going to be a long, the only problem is that you have this tension between the content owners, who are primarily the studios, and then the people who have the power, who run the pipes, are Apple, Netflix, Microsoft, Cisco. They're all technology companies, and they're not, Apple's the only one that actually is in the, well, it used to be in the content production business as well with Pixar. But that tension right there, nobody wants to let the other guy win, and they're going to keep fighting it out for quite some time. So the answer is there's probably not going to be one magical place where you can get everything for at least another decade.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually.
Which is unfortunate as a film fan, because I'd like to be able to go to one place and watch all that stuff.
Well, I mean, I think what changes, just to hop in for 2 more seconds, the way On Networks works is to bring content into, original content into On Networks, and control the rights, not to control the rights to develop a rights-oriented content library, but very specifically so that we can absolutely, without question, go get any screen, any geography, any use case, you know, any time, with no residual rights nightmare. And so, you know, as long as there is a residual rights nightmare to untangle, you're going to have this exact problem. And that's driven, in fact, you know, a very core component of our business model, which is how we exactly how we acquire content, how we bring content into the system. It's for those exact reasons. And so as platforms start to develop that can give some of the benefits of convergence and discoverability, and I want to get it where and when, how we can do it, I think the content that tends to win over time, and I think this is where, you know, in as much as I think all of our models are sort of indie-oriented models, we probably have a better shake at that than folks that are sitting on massive content libraries that are hopelessly encumbered.
Yes. So the question was, how many downloads do you need to be able to recoup an investment, and how many downloads is success? I think we're going to have different answers here.
Okay. So when On Networks talks about downloads or views, the way we describe, you know, the value proposition is different depending on which business model we're operating under. So from a licensing perspective, we really don't care. There are devices and geographies that are trying to launch, and they need a wealth of content, maybe along a specific topic, and that's a very standard license. It's completely independent of the notion of downloads. So where downloads and viewership matters is in an ad-supported model. And so where that happens, you know, this whole notion of understanding the distribution platform and being able to make sure we put the content on the right place at the right time to get the right viewer engaged with that content, we're making a very strong argument that says, you know, all viewers are not created equal. The viewers that are attached to a particular piece of content on the right system, that are deeply engaged, are more valuable than sort of the mass market, you know, shotgun approach to people viewing that. And so, you know, to recoup investments, to start sharing revenue, literally, you know, 100,000 of the right downloads with a piece of sponsored content can start dollars flowing between parties. But I think if you're thinking about a YouTube model, just to sort of make sure we're talking about the same sort of thing, YouTube, Google, this is a company, and Chris mentioned a little bit of this earlier, that makes their entire businesses up on pennies, right? So the notion of an aggregator business is a really hard business to, as a content owner, content producer, be viable. And it's great for the aggregator, right? They can go make, you know, look at their revenue, right? Like bajillion million dollars, 25 cents at a time. But, you know, participating in that system where you're adding your content or somebody else's content in that so that they can help monetize that, you're only going to pull pennies out at a time as well. So you have to, you know, that notion of downloads on a system that is not differentiating in the type of content, that's not targeting the right folks, that's not making that right value proposition, is going to be a very different statement. It's going to be hundreds of millions for a place like YouTube against a piece of content for that to start working, which is why understanding that VOD network is so important, right? What works where and why and when. So it's really about the quality of the user, right? It's not all created equal, and that is a platform as well as a content statement.
I'll just give a quick answer for us, which is slightly different. We have two different sides of the business. Ones that are things that we find that we're then working through other distributors and are going out much more broadly than just selling directly online. For a film that we list on bside.com and sell, the break-even number for us is a single unit. The cost, if you're just in the pure digital business and that's all you're doing and you're not spending additional money marketing and it's just available for sale, a $2.99 download, we're breaking even and cutting a check to a filmmaker. That's a very different threshold, though, than what is successful, unless people are making movies for a dollar or two. You know, the way I would define success is a filmmaker making their money back and then some. And you know, we have not done that yet. There's actually one film selling on B-Side right now where the filmmaker, across what he sold online direct with us and what he has done through just a self-release DVD, he's made his money back, and it's because he made a film for $25,000. It's a brilliantly funny film, and it's going to actually end up doing really well. But I think success, I come at this, my brother's a documentary filmmaker, and that's kind of how I got into this. And so I think the ultimate answer is success is when filmmakers are making their money back, and that's where the nobody knows anything part, from my perspective, comes in, because we haven't achieved that as a business yet. It's called Blood Car. It's awesome. It's a Blood Car. It played. I'll give you the 5 second. It played at 25 or so festivals that we saw. It was one of the number one or number two rated films by the audience at every festival. It's an eco horror comedy film about a vegan school teacher who invents a car that runs on blood, and it's absolutely brilliant.
That's good.
5 stars. You have probably a different answer than we do here.
So. I mean, I don't think that is would be less directed at me just because they really each film for us would just stand alone. I mean, I usually see it at one festival and then hopefully we can the whole team can see it and we'll make a decision. So for us, I mean, it's great when you can get buzz and from festivals. And then when we if we do acquire the film and we do, you know, slate it for a date and then we figure out which festivals for it, hopefully that it can go to then create, you know, promotion and buzz around it. For us, it would be more the momentum after an acquisitions rather than before. But I think that's different for
yeah. I think
guys,
we're dealing yeah. again with films at the next level down in terms of their prominence and exposure. My belief in general is that the festival circuit is basically the kind of new exhibition chain for most indies. It's the first and last place that a lot of these films are going to be seen in a dark room by a bunch of people. And the way that exhibition works today is some number of people see something and hear about it, and some number of people write about it and tell other people about it. And then that translates into DVD sales. And so I think more people that see it and hear about it is better. Now, the answer is if you ran on the festival circuit for a year and a half and then did nothing for 2 or 3 years, you probably won't get any benefit from that. But I think that films that play broadly and do well and end up getting write-ups and you can amass reviews and journalists and people who are championing your film, I think that's a great thing, personally.
Yeah.
Other questions? We have about 5 minutes. That probably is a topic for another panel. So if there are filmmakers in the room who are looking for music, this guy has some. And I don't want to cut you off, but we do have 4 more minutes on this topic here. So we don't produce films, so I'm sorry about that. Yes. I can tell you the person who's probably more educated than anyone else in the world about this is Reed Hastings, who's the CEO of Netflix, and his answer is 2012. So that's the best answer I can give.
Don't hold your breaths.
Well, no, that's soon, though. I mean, reasonably soon,
yeah.
Given that DVDs are a $36 billion worldwide business. So
no, it's really soon. I just think, what we touched on before, it's a matter of people adapting to the new the technology just in their homes at a very basic level in their home. And then,
Now, it would have been sooner if the whole Blu-ray thing didn't end when it did. Because that actually, I thought, I was going to predict personally, was going to be the death of DVDs. If you had both HD DVD and Blu-ray going on, no one was going to buy another DVD or another DVD player for the next 5 years. And so, I still have 900 LPs at home. I haven't bought one though in a long time. I think there will always be people who want to own stuff. I still buy CDs. My wife pushes me more to buy CDs than not, though I'm still happy to buy off iTunes and things like that. But I think there are people who have physical fetishes, and then I think there are people like our daughters who are 10 and 12 who, you know, view a CD as a, you know, a pain and something that can be lost or scratched, and their iPod is really all they know. And so I think in another 10 or 20 years, that might be a very different answer.
Yeah.
When we all get too old to pull out our credit cards, then I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah. I mean, I think the history of media, at least that I've seen, is that it tends to be additive versus, you know, displacement oriented, right? Radio is still around. So I think in general, I'd be surprised if it goes away forever. I mean, you could argue in the details of that, right? Like, does VHS ever go away because of DVD? But I think that notion of packaged media tends to be just additive.
Yeah, I mean, especially on the Hollywood level, I mean, the Spider-Man extra scenes, I don't think in that like respect that you'd get that maybe content elsewhere unless it got uploaded online. But because there's so many features, and I think they keep trying to add, you know, features for that or Criterion Collection, like there's definitely to that point people that like to collect and buy things. So
yeah, and I'll just to close that out, there's an interesting story that's, again, might not be relevant in 10 years, but a guy who's on our advisory board, his name is Dan Markham. He's a head of business affairs for Time Life Home Video, and he was the guy who basically marketed and distributed Ken Burns' Civil War documentary. And that was released as, I think, a 12 VHS set. And it sold some ridiculous number, like 600,000 copies of this $250 package. And he said about 8 years later, they got a complaint from someone who said that VHS cassette number 8 had a glitch an hour and a half into it. And so they sent him another one. And the same person then wrote back a month later saying, hey, this has had the same problem. They went and checked. And the 8th out of the 12 cassettes actually had a point where the sound just dropped out completely. And so they'd sold 650,000 copies and no one had ever actually watched cassette number 8. So the answer is there are people who like to have the thing up on their shelf, and having the physical thing is important. So that's
good data.
Yeah. We'll do one last one here because we're basically out of time.
Yes. Wonderful. I'm an IFC fan, so I'm sure that IFC supports the idea that cable and satellite are involved in independent film and VOD. For the folks who don't have that cable company ownership relationship, for the other two panelists, do you see a strong involvement for the cable and satellite companies going on for indie film VOD? And then last, if you could ask the audience if they would prefer for either a cable or satellite company versus an internet company to be more involved in that space, which would they take?
It's an interesting question. So a couple things.
Why don't we start with the audience just quickly?
Sure.
How many people have a strong opinion that they care that a cable company be more relevant in the independent film distribution
world versus an online company?
How many people think it should be?
Who would rather
company?
Distribute on a cable platform?
Okay. And okay.
Okay.
That's interesting.
And how many people would prefer it to be a cable company? Yeah. Okay. And how many people really don't care?
Yes. You just want distribution. So, I mean, I tend to agree with that, and it's sort of a reflection of the, you know, consumers want what they want, where and how they want it. So I would say all of the above is the answer that we give, right? In fact, I think, you know, an expertise in that is important. I will say that, you know, satellite has actual, you know, sort of a necessary exclusion from a lot of this discussion because of their challenges in delivering VOD in the first place. But I think, you know, that's sort of a technical argument. I think there's IPTV services that are coming on strong. I think there's cable services that are coming on strong. You can actually go look at the new CEO of Time Warner just said basically everything's got to go VOD as quickly as possible. So, you know, hopefully the answer is over time, you know, you don't have to choose. You don't have to optimize around one versus the other because it's really about getting your content in front of the eyeballs. And that's how all the business models work. But I think today still, you know, especially for independent producers, you have to go, you know, roll up your sleeves and pick your battles. And so, yeah, I mean, do what's efficient as far as that goes, or work with us.
Any wrap up, Lizzie? You are out of time.
No, just thank you for coming and being very attentive.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was good.